It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, food can bring a family together. That's especially true for our Food Friday guests this week who wrote a cookbook with their parents. We'll talk with them about how it came together and the importance of Chinese cooking in their family's history. Now I'd like to take a moment to courageously offer my regrets for certain events that may have happened. Rest assured, I'm not the sort of person who would do that sort of thing, and I'm very sorry to anyone who was oversensitive or foolish enough to misinterpret my actions or intentions in a negative light. Please know that my anguish over these events outweighs the impact on anyone who was harmed by those actions and who, when you think about it, probably had it coming. In closing, I express my willingness to put it all behind us by graciously accepting your forgiveness. Okay, that wasn't an actual apology for anything in particular. It was a demonstration of some lessons from our next guests, lessons in how not to do an apology. In their blog and in their new book, they say apologies are good, they're valuable, they help rebuild social ties if we do them better than I just did. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find it difficult in your life to apologize and to phrase it the right way? What were you taught about apologizing growing up? How do you teach your kids about saying they're sorry? What's the best apology you've ever gotten? What's the worst? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel are the founders of the website Sorry Watch, which analyzes public apologies, and their new book is called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. They're both authors and writers. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
And
Marjorie, that was a great apology.
I was going to say, Marjorie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. That was one of the worst apologies I've ever heard.
I was going to ask. I really tried. I drew real life lessons from your book. Marjorie, how does that stack up in the world of bad apologizing?
That was just gorgeously terrible. That hit just about every bad point other than I'm not perfect and I'm on a journey.
I am on a journey. It's true. Now, Susan, on a serious note, part of the point in tracking apologies and writing this book is you see a lot of benefits to good apologies. What do apologies do for us as people, as a society?
I think both as people and individuals and as a society, a good apology leaves us in better shape than we were in before. It not only heals relationships, but it leaves them stronger.
Marjorie, what led you and Susan into tracking apologies, both at SorryWatch.com and now with this new book?
We are both journalists and we love to research and we are longtime friends. And I used to live in San Francisco where Susan still lives. And now I'm in New York, although I have lots of Wisconsin family. And when I moved, Susan had this great idea that we could collaborate on this subject that interested both of us. And so we started doing the blog in 2012. And then in 2016, I think apologies really came to people's attention and the forefront of more people's interest when we had a president who had an innovative new take on apologies and not apologizing. And then we thought we could go into some research and really explore the notion of why apologies can be really courageous, difficult, vulnerable, brave acts in a book. So we did a lot more research and here we are.
And Susan, I wanted to ask about that. This idea sometimes that, well, I don't want to apologize because I don't want to admit wrongness. It makes me seem weak maybe if I apologize. Make the case for what Marjorie just said, that apologizing can be a sign of a certain strength.
Well, when you apologize, you make yourself vulnerable. You put yourself in a one-down position, something that we just instinctively avoid. But if you can push through that, actually apologize, you will look stronger. You will look more like a grown-up, more like a good person. And so ironically, if you go through and you let yourself look weak, you'll end up looking stronger.
Talking to Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. You can call in with your questions, your experiences with apologizing or lack of apologies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll spend some time on bad apologies. But Marjorie, can you start us off with the basics of what the elements are in a good apology?
Yeah, we say that you can apologize really well in 6.5 easy steps. They're easy to say, but psychologically, they can be really hard to do. Number one is you use the words I'm sorry or I apologize. You don't talk about regret as you did in your terrible apology in this that opened the segment. Number two, you name the thing that you did. You have to say it. Number three is you show that you understand why what you did was bad and hurtful. Number four is don't make excuses, which is all too easy to do. You can explain what you need to explain, but be really careful not to turn that into making excuses. Number five is say what you're doing to ensure that this won't happen again. What steps are you taking? And number six is if you can make an offer of repair of some sort, which isn't always a possible thing to do, but if you can make reparations, do that. And the 6.5, the all important half step is listen, let the other person have their say.
Susan, how do we get ourselves in the right mindset? You know, I know when I make mistakes and offend other people or, you know, just harm people in my life, I get defensive, right? I don't want to admit that I'm a bad guy. How do I get myself from there to a position where like, well, wait, I did do something that, you know, hurt somebody in my life. How do I get there?
Well, one thing that you can do is you can practice. You can practice on little things. Oh, I'm sorry, the salt is in the kitchen after all, and kind of get past the barrier of doing that. But one of the things that I think we're doing with the website is we give a lot of examples of bad apologies. In my research with learning, animal learning, in fact, I discovered that one of the ways that animals and people learn things is by watching others be taught. And so looking at bad examples of apologies, which we have lots of in the book, some of them pretty funny, is a really good way to learn how to do a good apology.
Marjorie, in the book, you share what the two of you view as a good apology. This is superstar Lizzo apologizing. She used the word spaz in one of her recent songs, a word used against people with disabilities often. Can you share some of that apology with us and why you found it was thought it was a successful one?
It was interesting. Both Beyonce and Lizzo had both used this word that is a slur against people with disabilities. And I just like Lizzo is just no nonsense. She went in, she got out, she didn't turn it all about this. I'll read it to you. This is from her Instagram. It's been brought to my attention that there is a harmful word in my new song, Girls. Let me make one thing clear. I never want to promote derogatory language. As a fat Black woman in America, I've had many hurtful words used against me, so I understand the power words can have, whether intentionally or in my case, unintentionally. I'm proud to say there's a new version of Girls with a lyric change. This is the result of me listening and taking action. As an influential artist, I'm dedicated to being part of the change I've been waiting to see in the world. XOXO, Lizzo. So, it's a little bit self-aggrandizing, but you're allowed to do that when you are Lizzo. But, the important thing here is she changed it before she even apologized, right? Like an apology isn't just empty words, it's taking action. And that's really the impressive thing that she did. And she wasn't defensive and she owned it.
Susan, where do people start to go wrong? Now, and let's not talk about celebrities here necessarily, but in our daily lives, what are some of the most common pitfalls when we try to apologize but don't hit some of those good notes?
Well, one of them is not even saying you're sorry, saying I feel bad about that, and then there's a real temptation to go into how bad you feel. Oftentimes we summarize some of the bad apologies as sorry if, sorry but, sorry you. Sorry you is where you turn around and accuse the other person of being so annoying you had to do the bad thing.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I went through a 12-step programs, actually several of them, and I was a very active participant. I went through counseling and the 12 steps make amends. Well, I tried to make sure I did that, and I it wasn't near as bad of an experience I thought it was. But the flip side of that is, in recent years, I've had three people make these kind of, I call them fake apologies, you know, and your guest, you brought it up, you know, I'm sorry, but, or you this, or, and one fellow, I was sitting with my girlfriend and he came up to me to apologize. And then when he got done, he started walking away. He says, well, I don't know what I'm apologizing for, but I guess I'm sorry. And I turned to my girlfriend and said, well, he just took it all back. It would have been better if he would have said nothing. Yeah. You know?
Randy, I want to ask, in that 12-step program, this is, I think, something a lot of people have experience with. Like, when you did the step where you're making amends and making apologies, like, did you feel like, hey, I'm ticking off a box here? Or did you come in with a sense like, hey, I did this person wrong and I'm really taking a shot and making amends for it?
Oh, I felt horrible about the things, you know, but, you know, I think it's also, you need to be self-reflective and really do a really strong looking depth into, and putting yourself in the other person's shoes too. And I think that's really important. And it seems like the apologies I mentioned, they never once tried to put themselves in my shoes. And I just thought that's kind of an odd thing, you know.
I gotcha. Randy, thank you so much for sharing that. Marjorie, Randy gives us a lot to work with there. What do you think?
First of all, congrats to Randy for, you know, doing recovery and for having all of this really good insight into apologies. One of the things we point out is that not everyone is as good at you know, a lot of times when people begin a 12-step program, they're super excited to go out there and make amends and, you know, make a fearless moral inventory. And that often means apologizing without thinking about the impact of your apology on the other person. So if you're approaching someone who hasn't heard from you in 5 years and your relationship may have ended poorly because of whatever drove you into recovery, think for a minute before you go off like a fire hose with your apologies. And it sounds like Randy really did that he kept at top of mind the fact that apologies are about the other person. And then when someone says to you, I guess, that.
Thanks for sharing your experiences, Randy, on both sides of apologies. We're talking to Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel about their new book. It's called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever gotten that apology that just made things worse? Have you gotten an apology that changed your life maybe for the better? Do you have difficulties apologizing, even when you know maybe you should? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel. Their new book is called Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies, chock full of advice on how to make a good apology and examples of how to make a bad one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about apologizing? Are you good at it, or is it hard for you to do? If so, you are not alone. Have you ever gotten a good one or a bad one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Middleton. Pat, hi.
Hi. So on the infrequent occasion when I've had to call a company over something that wasn't quite right, in my estimation, it seems like there's this, probably written by lawyers or risk managers, type of reaction that I get, and I wonder if others do too, which seems like it's built to deflect liability and just simply say, it doesn't matter really what the issue is. I'm sorry you feel that way. And then we never get really to the what is the issue. It's more about how they're sorry, how I feel. It really is a why bother kind of conversation. And maybe that's the whole point. I don't know. But I was wondering what you think about that.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, you've got a whole chapter on corporate apologies and non-apologies in the book.
Yeah, I think Pat is really onto something. I think that they are reading from scripts. I have definitely had that experience myself. I remember once dealing with an airline where the perfectly nice person on the phone was apologizing repeatedly for the confusion. And there wasn't any confusion. It was a deliberate airline policy to try and get me to pay extra for my seats. But she just had to read over and over, sorry for the confusion, sorry for the confusion. And other times they'll say, you know, we wrote about a dental practice that kept saying, we're sorry you feel this way. Well, yeah, you know, my mouth won't close properly and my other dentist says it's an outrage. So those are scripts that companies give to their employees who are forced to read them. They don't make people feel better. Like Pat, we can see right through it and it doesn't get rid of liability.
Pat, thanks a lot. Oh, go ahead.
A poor apology is actually worse than no apology. And when people, you know, people are determined to believe that this isn't the case, but a 2006 study by the Harvard Hospital System looked at the fact that good apologies do not increase the risk of, say, malpractice suits. And there is so much evidence that bad apologies actually cause them. And some malpractice lawyers think that 2/3 of malpractice suits are actually because of the failure to take responsibility and apologize and communicate openly, and people get vindictive.
Thanks a lot for that call, Pat. Liz joins us now in Sister Bay. Liz, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a situation when my mother-in-law did something not only to hurt myself, but my place of business. And she admitted she had done it. And then, you know, I expected an apology. And the apology was what you were just speaking about with the other guest. And she said, I am sorry you feel that way. But she did not say that she was sorry for what she had done or admit that it was wrong. And this was back in like 2021. And I'm just wondering, I still have problems like trying to let it go. And I'm just wondering how to move on.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. Marjorie, first of all, in many situations, maybe where we should give an apology, you talk about this in the book. We don't see ourselves as the bad guy. We come up with reasons why we weren't wrong in the first place.
Right. Like, I'm sure your mother-in-law has decided that there were really good reasons that she did what she did. And again, as I just said, with, you know, on a corporate level, a bad apology is in so many ways worse and more hurtful than no apology. And I'm really sorry that that's what you got. I don't know what the caller's relationship with her mother-in-law is like. I don't know if you have the kind of relationship where you can sit down and say, look, I'm still really hurting over what happened. And I would like to talk to you more about it. And I would like you to address, and then you say the X, Y, and Z. And, you know, you might want to do it in a letter because people often have a little more time to process and are a little less defensive when they have a little bit of distance rather than being cornered. But I don't think the caller should feel bad about feeling bad because that's what a bad apology does.
Thanks for that call, Liz. We are talking to Marjorie Engel and Susan McCarthy about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. Back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Mequon. Beth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a dear, dear friend who was a friend for probably 30 years who got mad at me for I don't know why. She never would tell me. She stopped completely talking to me. I've tried calling. I've sent her letters. We 4 years ago, we moved out of the town that we lived in. Now, this week, her husband died, and I would really like to send her a sympathy card. I don't know if I should apologize again in that sympathy card. I don't even know if she'll read the sympathy card. I feel bad. I don't know what I did. How do you apologize for something you don't know what you did?
Beth, thanks for the call. Susan, any thoughts for Beth?
Beth, I really feel for you. That is so hard. I will say that I think it's appropriate to send her a sympathy card. And in the sympathy card, don't bring up the apology or the mystery about what the apology is supposed to be for. That would be a separate conversation, which you may or may not be able to have. So I would send a sympathy card, you know, with, you know, maybe some memories of her late husband. And then if you can still try in a separate conversation to say, you know, I really feel bad that that we're estranged, and I feel like I did something, but I don't know what it is. Can you help me figure it out?
Beth, thanks a lot for the call and good luck. Alicia joins us now in Milwaukee. Alicia, hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Alicia?
I just wanted to say that I'm in retail pharmacy, and a lot of times people come to the pharmacy after maybe getting a not-so-good diagnosis, pretty bad news, and maybe feeling sad and sometimes angry, and they blow up because one prescription may be there and not another that the doctor said that they would send, or maybe there's something wrong with the prescription, so I have the prescription itself, but there's a problem with it. And so people get very angry, and I have had people call after they leave the pharmacy, call back and apologize. So I just wanted to say that those apologies do mean the world.
Alicia, thanks a lot for the call. And Marjorie, that takes us to a good point to end on. Leave us with some hope for what we can do with a good apology.
A good apology can mend fences. It can strengthen relationships. We have a post on our website about kintsugi, the Japanese art of fixing cracks with glue and gold. And a thing becomes stronger. The cracks don't disappear, but the thing is stronger and more beautiful after a fracture.
Marjorie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Susan, thanks for being with us.
You bet. That was great.
Been talking to Susan McCarthy and Marjorie Engel, founders of the website Sorry Watch. They joined us to talk about their new book, Sorry, 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 The Case for Good Apologies. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk with two sisters about the tradition of Chinese cooking in their family and how it led to writing a cookbook with their parents. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, federal pandemic funds for childcare are ending this year. We'll look at the ways that Wisconsin could improve access to affordable childcare around the state. Now, it's Food Friday. Food is one of the best ways to bring any family together. That's especially true for our next guests, their sisters who grew up learning Chinese cooking from their parents. In 2013, they started a family food blog, and now that's grown into a cookbook celebrating the flavors of China and their home kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What memories do you have of the kitchen bringing your family together? Did you find times in your adult life to get together with parents and cook some favorite dishes? Or do you bring kids in to the kitchen to work with you on making that family meal? And have you tried Chinese cooking of some sort in your kitchen? Do you have a wok? Do you have questions about how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah and Caitlin Leung, along with their parents Bill and Judy, are the authors of the new book, The Woks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese American Family. Sarah and Caitlin, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Now, Caitlin, can you talk about your family's food background and why this is so particularly important for you?
Yeah, our family is Chinese American, and we've always grown up kind of straddling those two worlds, and sometimes three worlds if you count the fact that my dad's Cantonese and my mom's Shanghainese. But food has always been super important to us as a family. You know, we grew up eating dinner together every night, or at least trying to, making an effort to, and cooking together. And yeah, I think over the years, it kind of quickly became apparent that me and Sarah had to roll up our sleeves and learn how to cook Chinese food and the food that we grew up with ourselves if we wanted to kind of keep it going for ourselves and the future.
Sarah, what are some of your first memories of actually working in the kitchen with your folks?
You know, I feel like every Chinese kid grows up being asked to make rice at some point, like make a pot of steamed rice. So that's probably like the first thing that I remember.
And let's talk about how this blog came to be. Caitlin, can you tell us a little bit about how this, you know, family love of cooking turned into your blog?
I'm actually going to pass it over to Sarah to answer that.
Go for it, Sarah.
Yeah, sure. So I think Caitlin is passing it to me because it's kind of, it was my story of having like just graduated from college and being unemployed and unsure what to do next that kind of spearheaded the blog. So yeah, in 2013, my parents were actually living in Beijing in China. My dad had recently gotten a temporary work assignment there. And so we were apart. We were, you know, separated by continents and by many time zones. And we kind of realized, Caitlin and I, that we had no idea how to make the foods that we were craving, which were the ones that our parents prepared for us growing up. And so we decided to start the blog as a way to stay in touch with each other while my parents were abroad, and also as a way to record those recipes so that Caitlin and I would know how to make them for ourselves.
And Caitlin, what were some of the first recipes that you realized, hey, this is something that's going to be fun to do as a long distance family?
That's a great question. Honestly, I think the first recipes that we kind of thought of were the easiest ones, the low hanging fruit, if you will, of the stuff that me and Sarah had actually most successfully cooked together, because it was like, oh, well, duh, that's the very least we can do. And then pretty quickly we ran out of those. But one recipe that I remember is my mom's red braised pork belly, which is a super famous Shanghainese dish and one that we were very eager to get down on paper. All of us, not just me and my sister, but also my mom, who, you know, really, I think we all, at the start, we all really embraced documenting pretty much any recipe that came to mind because we all just thought it was such a cool idea. And I think my mom in particular was very much eager and almost felt a sense of urgency in passing the information on to sort of the new generation with, you know, her own daughters being the representatives of that, but also, you know, actually the people of our generation more broadly.
We're talking to Caitlin and Sarah Leung. It's Food Friday. They have a new cookbook out that they wrote with their parents. It's called The Walks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese-American Family. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share about cooking with your family, maybe handing down or receiving those great family recipes from a parent or grandparent, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, we've got a few recipes from Sarah and Caitlin up at wpr.org/foodfriday. We'll check a couple of those out in a minute. Now, Sarah, let's talk. You have a list of important equipment. No surprise. A wok is featured prominently in the list. I once owned a wok. I don't know much about wok quality, but I know this was not a good one. It did not enable me to cook great food. What for somebody like me who would like to have a good wok, what should I look for, Sarah?
Yeah, sure. So you're looking for a wok that's made with carbon steel. Carbon steel is a great material because it's lightweight, so you can actually handle the wok and lift it a lot easier than, say, a cast iron or a stainless steel wok. And it's also going to be relatively thin. And the reason for that is you want the wok to be able to heat up relatively quickly, especially when you've already added food to it. So a lot of wok cooking, particularly stir frying, involves cooking over very high heat. So you want a wok that's thin enough such that when you add food to it, it's going to be able to heat up that much more quickly after it's kind of cooled down, after you added those ingredients. Also, you're looking for, I suggest, a wooden handle. Sometimes these metal handles can get really hot when the wok is sitting on the stove. So a wooden handle just kind of prevents you from burning yourself. And a really nice lid as well, because the lid is going to allow you to do things like steam and braise in that wok, and even smoke things in your wok. So I would say those are my top tips for picking a wok.
And then, Caitlin, I understand you're responsible for something that shows up a lot in the book, a chili oil that we make at home. Then we've got it sitting around using a bunch of different dishes. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's, I feel like I'm the poster child for our homemade chili oil because it's definitely one of my favorites. And I feel like it was such a cool moment in sort of quote unquote the blog's history when we discovered how to make our own Sichuan style chili oil, because it's actually pretty deceptively simple, but you know, until you figure out what those key steps are, you kind of can't imagine achieving those flavors in your own home kitchen. But yeah, basically it's as much a condiment as it is a cooking ingredient. So I think when we first discovered it, we're a little bit more nascent in our Chinese cooking adventures, we were more likely to use chili oil as a condiment for, you know, noodles, fried rice or dumplings, what have you. But we kind of graduated to cooking more Sichuan dishes like Mapo Tofu, where that calls for like a quarter cup of our homemade chili oil. So it's really great to make it at home because you just do a little oil infusion. You pour hot oil, you pour that hot flavored oil over chili flakes and you have a chili oil. And then you can use like massive quantities of it and not be worried about, you know, running out of a little jar that is, you know, admittedly can be kind of expensive. So yeah, definitely one of our faves. And if that's like, if you're looking for a starter recipe from the cookbook, I would say that's a really good one because it kind of opens a lot of doorways.
And we've got that at WPR.org/Food Friday. And it stars in another dish we have up there, shortcut Dan Dan noodles. I'm looking at the picture in the book right now. Sarah, it looks delicious. Can you tell us about this dish a little bit?
Absolutely. So that dish was actually my sister's invention. So Dan Dan noodles it's a Sichuan dish. And it can be kind of complex to make it from scratch at home. So you're going to make a sauce. There's kind of this like relish of ground pork and an ingredient called sui mi yatai, which is a preserved vegetable that you can find in Chinese grocery stores. And you're going to boil noodles and all that. So the most difficult part of the recipe is actually creating, like layering the flavors of the sauce. So the shortcut aspect of this recipe is making that sauce in advance, and it actually keeps for several weeks in your refrigerator. So you can just kind of pull out that jar of sauce anytime the craving for a bowl of noodles hits. And all you have to do is cook off the ground pork with a little bit of garlic, ginger, and that preserved vegetable I mentioned, and mix it with the boiled noodles, maybe throw a little bit of baby spinach in there, or you could also use like any leafy green that you like, mix it with the sauce and you're good to go.
We're talking to Sarah and Caitlin Leung on this week's edition of Food Friday. They are co-authors along with their parents of the new cookbook, The Walks of Life. They write the food blog of the same name. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you cook as a family? Did you cook with your parents growing up? Do you cook with your kids as you're raising them? Do you have favorite food traditions that were handed down? Could you write a book like our guests did, or would you want to? And what questions do you have about some of the Chinese cooking we are talking about? Do you have favorite dishes maybe you've had at a friend's or maybe in your family growing up or at a restaurant and you'd like to try to create them at home? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Check out some recipes from our guests at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Sarah and Caitlin Leung, co-authors of the new cookbook. The other co-authors are their parents, by the way. It's called The Walks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese-American Family. You can join in with your experiences, your questions with Chinese food, Chinese-American food, or cooking with your family at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I actually lived in Chengdu, Sichuan, for about 5 years. My wife is from there. And we came back to the U.S. last year, and she's always cooking dishes that I remember. So a few of them I wanted to bring up was chuan chuan, which is kind of like a hot pot. I call it a hot pot for one, I know you guys were talking about Dan Dan Mien, which is also really good. I like Zha Zha Mien. And of course, you know, the traditional Sichuan spicy hot pot. I also wanted to ask your two guests what their favorite local Sichuan food would be.
Great. Hey, Jack, thanks for sharing that experience. Let's start with Caitlin, a favorite Sichuan food Jack wants to know.
That's a great question. And I loved hearing about all of your favorite dishes. Mm. I have to say, I think the old standby Mapo tofu is my favorite.
And that's tofu, and it's usually got some pork in it. Do I have that right, Caitlin?
Yeah, it's like ground pork and like a spicy bean paste and chili oil laden sauce with Sichuan peppercorn, and it's really, really good.
And would it work with your ultimate chili oil, Caitlin?
It does indeed.
Excellent. Sarah, do you have a favorite to share with Jack?
Yeah, my favorite is a little bit of an obscure one. It's called Fuchi Fei Pian, and it's like... it's normally made with tripe and tongue, which I know is kind of polarizing, but it's really tasty. The sauce is incredible. The mixture of textures is really interesting. You can find it in the appetizer section of most Sichuan restaurants here in the U.S., and it's just a really classic Sichuan dish. And actually, in our cookbook, we have a vegan version of that dish. So the veganized version kind of uses different types of tofu and seitan to kind of mimic those textures and flavors. So if you're a little bit, you know, nervous to try tripe, the vegan version might be the way to go.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jack, at 800-642-1234. Kay joins us now in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi. My aunt and uncle lived in Taiwan for many years when he was in the military. And she would send recipes to our family, and my mother would make sweet and sour pork or fried rice. And we really enjoyed it, and it was a nice change from Midwestern cooking.
And Kay, is that something you still make to this day?
Yes, yes, we still do. My mother modified the recipes a little bit, so I have to kind of go back and unmodify them a little bit to make them a little more traditional.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me of something I wanted to ask about. Your dad, let's throw this to Caitlin, does a lot in the way of Chinese-American cooking and in some ways adapting things from China and integrating them with, you know, maybe a common Midwestern dish or other parts of the country. What kind of things come out of that?
Yeah, my dad is definitely the point person on all things Chinese-American, Americanized takeout, restaurant-style cooking, because he actually had experience growing up working summer jobs and to pay for college and things like that in restaurant kitchens with my grandfather, his stepfather, who actually was a professional restaurant chef. And so a lot of his cooking know-how comes from the training that he got during those years. And then later, my grandparents actually opened their own Chinese restaurant. So he had even more experience kind of making those beloved Americanized dishes that kind of everybody knows and loves so well, no matter where you are across the country. And in terms of, I think, some highlights, his Chinese takeout fried chicken wings are really good. Mm. They like are so, so delicious. It's kind of the original recipe that my grandfather would make. And we've brought that forward into the on the blog and now into our cookbook.
We are talking to Sarah and Caitlin Leung on Food Friday, their new cookbook with their parents. It's called The Walks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese-American Family. Here's another one. Sarah, we've got a WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got your name on this in the cookbook here. Pork and shrimp, a su mai. Can you tell us about that one?
Sure. So su mai is a dim sum dish. So it's a steamed dumpling with pork and shrimp. If you've ever been to dim sum, su mai is like one of the most recognizable or common items. And it's actually shocking how easy it is to make at home. In the recipe in the cookbook, we use a stand mixer actually to mix the filling. because you want to really emulsify that filling together to get it to have that, like, the right texture. And to do that, you kind of have to stand there and stir for quite a while, but to have a stand mixer do it for you is that much better. And you can use store-bought Hong Kong style dumpling wrappers to make these, or wonton wrappers. And you basically just fill the wrappers with the filling. You can put a little garnish on top if you like, but you don't have to. And you just steam them, and they are delicious, particularly with Caitlin's chili oil or or with some chili garlic sauce, which is also delicious.
We've got that up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Okay, Caitlin, something that's been nagging at me since I started looking at your book. Right off the bat, you describe your family as a bunch of strong-willed individuals. Now, you know, my wife and I, when we cook together, we're very strong-willed and have very strong attitudes about what happens in the kitchen. We've learned one of us is the prep cook, the other one is the chef, and that's how we can work harmoniously. How do you manage four different personalities, either working together in the kitchen or, say, planning out a cookbook?
That's a good system. Not a bad system at all. I think over the years, we've definitely learned to, number one, play to each other's strengths, similar to you and your wife. But also, I think that as we work together and as a collective, we also have had to learn, perhaps, how to step aside and kind of let each individual perspective have its, you know, kind of time to, you know, breathing time for us all to kind of reflect on, to say like, okay, if somebody has a recipe idea or somebody has, you know, a topic that they want to talk about, like, we all kind of evaluate it sort of equally, even though we are kind of parents and children, you know, which is like inherently a hierarchical relationship, but bringing that equality to the table when we do have our kind of blogging hat on and our cookbook hat on is definitely important. And as we were developing the cookbook, we kind of had a system where we allocated everybody kind of the recipes that we thought that each of us would do best with. And then as we went along, it kind of became clear that, you know, different recipes were trickier than others. And we would sort of do like swap meet on recipes of like, oh, I'll trade you this recipe for that recipe. And kind of, you know, in that way, really brought the same strengths that we have in the blog into the cookbook, which is that all of the recipes go through the gauntlet, I like to say, of four different perspectives. And, you know, the evaluations and the kitchen skills that come with each of our unique backgrounds.
And Sarah, not every family is going to do a food blog or write a cookbook together, but can you give us some encouragement to, you know, get together between generations, talk about the foods we grew up with, and share those recipes and experiences with each other in our families?
Absolutely. I think it's so important to pass these recipes down, to write them down. If you have a favorite dish that, you know, your mom, your dad, your grandparents make, take the time to go and write that down, because, you know, once our elders pass on, those recipes often disappear. And we've heard so many stories of that from our readers of like, oh, I thought this recipe was gone forever. And, you know, I tried yours and it tastes just like my, you know, what my dad used to make, and that kind of thing. We hear that so often. So I would just say, if you have recipes that you love, definitely take the time to reach out to your parents, to your grandparents, your great grandparents, and really study what they're doing in the kitchen. You know, you can just make a fun afternoon of it. Just kind of watch what's happening, write it down. And then to send it out to like the rest of your family, that's like, what a gift that is, you know? So I would highly encourage everybody to do that.
We'll leave it there. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
And Caitlin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Been talking to Sarah and Caitlin Leung, who write the food blog, The Walks of Life, along with their parents. And the four of them are the co-authors of this new cookbook we've been talking about. It's The Walks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese American Family. You can find some of those recipes we talked about today with Sarah and Caitlin online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try them out and let us know how it goes. And you could share your thoughts maybe about cooking with your family on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, what does it take for a country to be happy? Get the results of the World Happiness Index. Join the conversation. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We talk about the power of radio sometimes. Here's an example. Our radio signal is so powerful that somebody was able to pick it up in northern Finland. We got an email today from Hanu, a radio fan in Helsinki, Finland. He says he has a listening station for his hobby. It's up north, meaning in this case, 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle. He has several 3,000-foot-long wire antennas. He was going over his audio from last October, and he found that he had picked up a signal. It includes a guy interviewing somebody, and at one point, this guy gives the number 800-642-1234. Hanu sent a sample. I won't play it here. It's kind of rough, but yes, indeed, the guy in the clip is me. Hanu picked up the WHA 970 signal from over 4,000 miles away. Not the first time. He heard us 10 years ago. I remember that. He sent a note then. Hanu, if you're listening right now, tervetuloa to Wisconsin. And hey, listen Monday morning at 8. Find out why Finland's one of the happiest countries in the world. We're big in Finland. This is Central Time.